He walked through the front door of the apartment, expecting another quiet evening. Instead, he froze at the sound of yelling and the sight of his roommate, Kyle McCullough, knelt over another man with a knife in hand. Blood covered the victim's face. Within minutes, Kyle cleaned the scene, placed the body in a plastic tote, and disappeared into the night. That roommate didn't call police. Instead, days later, he led the victim's sister to the hideous crime scene by the river. By then, Kyle was long gone, until a text message hinting at vengeance came. "You lucky to be alive. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't." Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1, The Roommate Who Stayed Silent. The night was warm in the small suburb of Des Moines, Washington. Quiet, almost deceptively so. Inside the modest apartment tucked away on 216th Street, the usual hum of routine filled the air. The faint clatter of dishes, the flicker of a muted television, and the casual drone of conversation between roommates. Nothing suggested that within the next few hours, that silence would be shattered by screams, blood, and a betrayal that would echo through the lives of everyone involved. Cameron had lived with Kyle McCullough for 6 months. They weren't close, just two guys splitting rent in a cramped unit, trying to make ends meet. Kyle was quiet, kept to himself, but there was always something in his eyes, something tense, coiled, like a spring waiting to snap. The third man, David Aguayo, had only recently entered the picture. David was bright, full of energy, with a disarming smile and a talent for making friends wherever he went. But Kyle didn't like him, not one bit, and that made things complicated. David had started dating a woman Kyle had once been with, someone he never quite got over. Her name was Lena Torres. She wasn't living with either of them, but her name came up often in conversations, especially when Kyle had been drinking. It wasn't jealousy, at least not on the surface. It was something deeper, something twisted. Kyle spoke of her like an unfinished chapter, like someone who owed him more than just closure. The night of June, I tweeted, he was impulsive, often broke, sometimes careless, but he was kind and funny and loyal. He never turned away someone in pain, not even Kyle. That's what Maria couldn't let go of. David had gone to that apartment to try and make peace, and Kyle turned peace into murder. Investigators later revealed chilling details about Kyle's state of mind in the days leading up to the killing. His search history was filled with terms like how to dispose of a body, murder sentencing, Washington State, love triangle, murder stories. He had also researched restraining orders, not how to file one, but how to avoid getting served with one. He'd written several unsent emails to Lena in his drafts folder. They ranged from heartfelt apologies to venomous accusations. One read, "You broke me. I hope every time you close your eyes, you see what you did." But Lena didn't break Kyle. Kyle broke himself. Maria spent months working with the prosecutor's office, sitting through hearings, reliving her brother's last hours in excruciating detail. She learned that the 911 call never came from Cameron. It came from her. After Cameron showed her the body, she didn't scream and run. She pulled out her phone and dialed immediately. "There's a body in a tote by the river. It's my brother." The dispatcher asked how she knew. "Because I'm looking at his face. When Kyle was arrested, he didn't resist. He didn't cry. He didn't confess. He simply looked at the officers and said, guess it's over then. At the precinct, detectives played the game of slow unraveling, showing him bits of evidence, letting silence stretch between questions. Kyle said very little. He asked for a cigarette, asked for the time, then said, "It should have been her." The detective paused. "Lena?" Kyle didn't answer. He just smiled. A slow, sick smile that never reached his eyes. That quote never made it into the courtroom testimony. Too ambiguous, too volatile, but Maria never forgot it. It should have been her. It told her everything she needed to know. David wasn't the target. He was collateral. Kyle wanted to hurt Lena, and he did, by destroying the one person she truly loved. The first time Maria visited the river alone, she brought one of David's old hoodies, navy blue, worn thin at the elbows. She laid it near the water and waited. The trees rustled. A heron flew overhead, and for a moment, she thought she heard him laughing. It was just wind, just memory, but it filled her with something she hadn't felt since he died. Resolve. She began speaking publicly, at community events, high schools, women's shelters. Her talk was always the same. She didn't lead with violence or trauma. She led with this. "This is the story of my brother and the two people who couldn't let go of each other." She told crowds what obsession looked like when it wore a friendly face, what manipulation sounded like when it masqueraded as love. She told them about the warning signs. She told them how silence kills and how watching something happen, then doing nothing, is a choice with consequences. A reporter asked her once, "Do you think Kyle's sentence was fair?" Maria looked down, thinking. Then she said, 18 years doesn't bring my brother back. It doesn't erase what he went through. But it stops Kyle from doing this to anyone else. That's something." She paused. "But fair? No. There's nothing fair about any of this." By fall, Maria had started a fund in David's name, the Aguayo Project. Its mission: raise awareness of interpersonal violence, especially when it hides under the surface of relationships. It began small. Local volunteers, printed flyers, coffee shop meetups, but word spread. Soon, the Aguayo Project had a podcast. School partnerships, counselors trained in emotional manipulation and coercive control. Maria's voice became one of clarity in a world that so often confused passion with danger. One night, after speaking at a university event, Maria received a handwritten letter. No return address, no name. It read, "You don't know me, but I knew Kyle. Not well. Just through mutual friends. I remember thinking something about him was off. But I never said anything. I wish I had. I'm sorry. For whatever it's worth." There was no signature, just a single line at the bottom. "We failed him. You didn't." Maria cried when she read it, not because of what it said, but because someone finally had owned their silence. As winter came, the river iced over. The candles by the cross stopped burning, but the memory stayed. People still came, still left flowers, still whispered David's name, and every time they did, the ghost in the river stirred, not in fear, but in justice. Chapter 5, Kyle's Prison Mine. From the moment the cell door clanked shut, Kyle McCullough knew two things. One, he was never going to be the same again. And two, he didn't care. In the controlled chaos of Washington State Penitentiary, Kyle wasn't the loudest. He wasn't the most feared, but he was the most still. That made people nervous. He spent his days mostly in silence, head down, eyes tracking every movement like a predator sizing up prey. Other inmates called him Ghost, not because he was quiet, but because it felt like he was always haunting the edge of something, watching, waiting. He never spoke about the murder, never asked for updates on his case, never mentioned Lena, David, or Cameron. But inside, his mind was a hurricane. Kyle saw the stabbing play on loop every time he closed his eyes, not in a flashback kind of way, not like trauma, but like a movie he directed, frame by frame. His mind lingered on the feel of the blade, the stunned look on David's face, the moment time seemed to stop. And every time, he told himself the same thing. He deserved it. But the deeper truth was one Kyle wouldn't admit aloud, not even to himself. David hadn't stolen Lena. She had left on her own. And that, more than anything, shattered Kyle's carefully constructed sense of control. In prison, Kyle wrote obsessively. Not letters, not apologies, notebooks. He filled 6 within the first year. Tiny handwriting, no margins, endless ramblings about justice, betrayal, and destiny. One entry read, "There is no such thing as coincidence. She walked away. He walked in. I was erased. People forget that silence is a provocation. I answered it." Another, "I'm not angry anymore, just awake. The world is built on lies we tell to protect the weak. I told the truth, and they locked me away for it." The prison psychologist, Dr. Rowan, met with Kyle monthly, court mandated. Their sessions were long and often fruitless. Dr. Rowan described Kyle's psyche as borderline delusional with narcissistic deflection. In layman's terms, Kyle saw himself as a victim, even while holding the bloodied knife. When asked about David, Kyle said he walked into something he didn't understand when, and asked about Lena, "She was mine before she became anyone else's." When asked if he felt remorse, "I feel resolve." Dr. Rowan stopped writing after that because there was nothing more to explore. Kyle didn't make friends behind bars, but he earned a strange kind of respect. He kept his head down, kept to his routines, never bragged about the murder, never played the tough guy. Inmates called him the monk, solitary, controlled. But one afternoon during yard time, something changed. A younger inmate, new to the system, walked up to Kyle, nervous, pale. "I heard you killed someone," he said. Kyle didn't look up from his book. The boy kept talking. "They say it was over a girl." Kyle turned the page. "It was over truth." The boy nodded and walked away, and that was it. But for Kyle, that moment mattered, because it confirmed what he always wanted to believe, that even behind bars, his story had power. Meanwhile, the outside world moved on. Lena had vanished from the public eye. Cameron changed his name and disappeared into anonymity. Maria became a local voice for domestic violence prevention. But Kyle's name, his legacy, still echoed in news segments, online articles, podcast episodes. And each time, it painted him as what he despised most: ordinary, another jealous ex-boyfriend, another statistic, another man who couldn't take no for an answer. That narrative cut deeper than any prison shank, because Kyle didn't believe he was like the others. He believed he was chosen. In his fourth year behind bars, Kyle received a single envelope in the mail. No return address, no name. Inside was a photograph. It was a selfie. Lena. She looked tired, different, but it was her. Written on the back in bold black ink were 6 words, "I hope it was worth it." Kyle didn't flinch. He placed the photo inside his latest notebook and turned to a blank page. At the top, he wrote, "Chapter 1," then began to write again. In the same prison, Kyle started attending group therapy sessions, required for his behavioral evaluation. At first, he said nothing. Just watch. But eventually he spoke. The first time he said, "I never hurt anyone who didn't invite it." The room went quiet. Another inmate challenged him. "So, the guy you killed asked for it?" Kyle didn't blink. He knew the game. He stepped on something sacred. That has consequences. The therapist ended the session early. Later, in his cell, Kyle replayed the exchange. He knew his words scared people. That was the point. Fear, Kyle believed, was the purest form of respect. One night during a lockdown, another inmate slipped a note under Kyle's door. "How'd it feel?" No name, just curiosity. Kyle didn't answer. He just smiled, because deep down, he knew the answer was complicated. It felt like control. And then, for a long time, it felt like nothing at all. In his fifth year, Kyle petitioned to start a writing workshop for inmates. It wasn't about rehabilitation. It was about influence. They approved it. He named it Ink After Silence. Every week, men with stories, violent, broken, raw, sat in a circle and bled through ink. But Kyle didn't share his story, not directly. He gave feedback, asked questions, shaped narratives. One inmate wrote a piece about betrayal. Kyle circled a sentence and said, "This is your knife, twist it." The man nodded. And in that moment, Kyle realized something. Even without freedom, he still held a blade. But what Kyle didn't know, couldn't know, was that outside those prison walls, his name was no longer a warning. It was a case file, a tragedy, a lesson. And with each year that passed, fewer people remembered the man. They remembered the murder and the silence that followed. Chapter 6, The Lies. We Live With It was 2 years after Kyle's sentencing when Lena Torres finally returned to Washington, not to visit family, not for closure, for court. Cameron had filed a petition to legally change his name. A requirement of the deal he made with the prosecutor's office to avoid formal charges. The court needed character statements, and despite everything, Lena agreed to appear. She hadn't seen him since the day David's body was found. In her mind, Cameron had been frozen in time, sweaty, shaking, standing by a riverbed with a terrible secret dripping from his skin. She hated him for what he didn't do. But part of her also understood. Fear is a prison. Not just the kind with steel bars, but the kind people build inside themselves. And Cameron had been locked in his for a long, long time. The courtroom was small, just two benches and a wooden rail. Cameron sat at the far end, dressed in a plain blue shirt, shoulders slumped. He barely looked up when Lena entered. When he did, his eyes were bloodshot, exhausted. The judge asked for any statements. Lena stepped forward. She hesitated, then said, "I hated him. For a long time I hated him, for watching, for helping, for doing nothing. But then I realized he was as broken as the rest of us, just in a different way. If the point of this process is healing, then yes, let him change his name, let him move on, but let us never forget why he needed to." Cameron's hands trembled. He nodded once, eyes brimming with something between shame and relief. Outside the courthouse, they stood in awkward silence. The city had changed, new buildings, new people, but the wound between them still pulsed beneath the surface. Lena finally spoke. "I still think about him, every day." Cameron swallowed. "I know. Sometimes I wonder what I could have done differently." "Said differently." He shook his head. "It wasn't you." Lena looked him dead in the eyes. "Wasn't just me either." They stood there, not as enemies or allies, but as two people walking forever with a shadow between them. Then, without another word, they turned and walked in opposite directions. That night, Lena sat on her balcony, wine in hand, old voicemail pulled up on her phone. Kyle's voice played, low and eerie. "I just wanted to say thank you for showing me the truth. I'm done pretending. I see it all now." She listened to it three times. On the fourth, she deleted it, not because she forgave him, but because she refused to carry his voice into her future. Across the state, Maria Aguayo was preparing for a different kind of meeting. The Aguayo Project had grown exponentially. It now partnered with legal clinics, law schools, and community programs. Her work had made national news. But one letter changed everything. It came from a woman in Oregon, the sister of a young man killed by his ex-girlfriend in a twisted domestic violence incident. Her note read, "No one believed he was in danger. He told me once, 'She's going to kill me.' And I laughed. I didn't know women could do that, but they can. I believe you when you say love turns dangerous. I just wish I had believed him." Maria sat with the letter for an hour. Then she called her board and expanded the Aguayo Project's mission to include all victims, regardless of gender. Because justice, she believed, wasn't a straight line. It was a circle. Everyone deserved a place in it. Months passed. Maria testified before a state committee about changing the classification of emotional coercion in domestic cases. She argued that obsessive behavior, threats, and psychological manipulation should be treated with the same gravity as physical violence. One legislator pushed back. "Are we supposed to make every bad breakup a felony?" Maria stood tall. "No, but when someone says, 'I'm scared,' we listen. And when we hear silence, we lean in harder." Her words went viral. A week later, a high school girl walked into a counselor's office and said, "I think my boyfriend's a Kyle. They took it seriously." That girl's life changed, maybe even saved. Maria never knew her name, but that's how healing works, quietly, one life at a time. Cameron now worked under a different name at a halfway house in another state. He cooked meals, changed sheets, took out trash. Some nights, when it was quiet, he sat with the residents and listened to their stories, most of them full of violence, silence, and regret. He never shared his own. But sometimes, when someone said, "I don't know why I didn't do something," he'd nod a little too quickly, because he understood. Kyle, meanwhile, remained at Washington State Penitentiary. Word spread that his workshop, Ink After Silence, had ended abruptly. Rumor had it another inmate had read one of Kyle's journals and turned it in to the warden. It described a future reckoning for the people who betrayed him, Lena, Cameron, even Maria. Kyle was moved to solitary for a psychological evaluation. They found nothing actionable, but his journals were confiscated, dozens of them, full of anger, full of venom, full of obsession, disguised as philosophy. His pen had finally been taken away, but his thoughts, still dangerous, still alive. The ripple effect of June 17th, 2022, never stopped expanding in Lena's chest, in Cameron's conscience, in Maria's mission, in every story told by survivors, in every empty chair at a family dinner. That's the truth about these kinds of crimes. They don't end at sentencing. They echo. On the third anniversary of David's death, Maria returned to the river. This time, she wasn't alone. She brought Lena. They stood in silence. No photos, no press, just two women bound by the same ghost. Lena placed a single white lily near the water, Maria lit a candle, and for the first time in a long time, neither of them cried. Chapter 7. The Final Silence. It was late spring when the letter arrived. No stamp, no return address, just a plain white envelope slipped into the mailbox of the Aguayo Project's headquarters in Seattle. Maria found it during her routine Monday sweep, sandwiched between donation receipts and flyers. The handwriting was familiar, sharp, controlled, cold. Inside was a single piece of paper. Tell them what they want. Let them believe. But you and I know the truth. He wasn't a victim. He was a thief. And I was the consequence. K. There was no mistaking it. Kyle McCullough had written from prison again. Maria folded the letter in half without flinching. She'd read worse, heard worse. But this one didn't feel like a threat. It felt like a man screaming into the void, trying to remind the world he still existed, trying to rewrite his legacy, one twisted sentence at a time. But no one was listening anymore, and that was his final punishment. 3 months later, Kyle was moved to a different facility, less violent, more structured. He hadn't shown aggression, but his mental health evaluations flagged him as at risk for dissociative thought loops and delusional identification with perceived righteousness. The clinical language masked a brutal truth. Kyle had built a religion around his own actions. He wasn't just the killer. He was the crusader, the martyr of a story no one wanted to hear anymore. Meanwhile, Lena Torres had quietly rebuilt her life in a coastal Oregon town. She worked at a nonprofit, ran a youth mentorship program, and spent her weekends hiking trails no one else walked. It wasn't about escape anymore. It was about quiet, about choosing to live outside the shadow of what had been done to her and because of her. But some nights, she still woke up in a cold sweat, not from nightmares, from silence, the same silence that came right before the scream, the same silence Cameron had lived in, the same silence Maria had broken. For years, Lena refused to tell her full story. People speculated, articles guessed, podcasts twisted, but she stayed silent until one day she didn't. It started with a podcast invitation from a rising true crime journalist, young, respectful, and relentless in her empathy. She didn't want the salacious version. She wanted Lena's truth. Lena said yes. Her voice, calm but trembling, carried through earbuds and car speakers across the country. I loved them both in different ways, but one of them saw me as a person. The other saw me as property. That's not love. That's obsession. I replayed it for years. If I had answered Kyle's call earlier, if I had gone to the apartment instead of David. But here's the truth I had to face. I didn't kill anyone. And I don't have to carry his knife for the rest of my life. The episode went viral. Not because of the crime, because of her grace. Letters poured in from survivors, from families, from men and women who had escaped their own Kyle before it was too late. Some didn't. Some barely made it. But Lena's voice had cracked something open. And once it was open, it wouldn't close again. Back in Des Moines, Washington, the apartment where David had been murdered had long been demolished. The entire building had been cleared, the land now an empty lot with overgrown weeds and a rusted chain-link fence. A real estate company tried to develop it, but neighbors protested. Some said it was cursed. Others said it was sacred. Either way, nothing was ever built there again. Cameron, now living under a different identity, sent Lena a letter. Short, handwritten. I heard your voice. Thank you for saying what I couldn't. I hope someday I'm worthy of the forgiveness I keep asking myself to believe in. She didn't reply, but she kept the letter, and that was enough. In prison, Kyle was given access to a shared tablet to participate in a state-sponsored journaling program for violent offenders. He wrote constantly, but this time with an audience. Every word was monitored, every entry archived. But something changed in his tone. Less fury, less fire, more emptiness. One entry stood out. I used to think silence was punishment, but I see now it's truth. The world went on without me. My name is no longer a warning, just a footnote in someone else's healing. Kyle never admitted guilt, never said sorry, but the words hung there, a small fracture in the fortress he built around himself. And that fracture let in a sliver of light. Maria later told a group of survivors, "Sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is choose to keep living after someone tried to erase you." She paused, then added, "And sometimes the deepest justice isn't locking them away. It's forgetting them." On the 5-year anniversary of David's murder, a candlelight vigil was held at the river. Lena read a poem. Maria read a letter David had written her at age 16. Cameron didn't attend, but sent a donation with a single note, "For David's name, not mine." Dozens gathered. Some cried. Some lit candles. Some just stood still, heads bowed. And in that moment, under a sky of soft stars, there was no hate, no vengeance, no courtroom, just silence. But this time, it wasn't heavy. It was peace. 17th, 2022 began like many others. Cameron had just come back from his shift at the gas station. He kicked off his shoes, grabbed a Gatorade, and sank into the couch. Kyle was already there, unusually quiet, staring blankly at the television screen, not really watching. There was an energy in the room, dense, charged. "What's up with you?" Cameron asked, half joking. Kyle didn't answer right away. Then, "You ever feel like someone just ripped your heart out and danced on it?" Cameron raised an eyebrow. "I mean, sure. Haven't we all?" Kyle laughed once, sharp and hollow. "Nah, not like this." A knock came at the door, sudden and jarring. Kyle jumped to his feet before Cameron could say anything. He opened it without looking through the peephole. David stepped in like he'd done before, grinning, loose, familiar. But this time there was tension. The air tightened around them instantly. Cameron would later swear he saw it in Kyle's eyes right then. A switch had flipped. "What's going on?" David asked casually. "Lena said you wanted to talk." Kyle nodded slowly. "Yeah, we need to clear the air." They walked down the short hallway toward Kyle's bedroom. Cameron stayed in the living room, his gut twisting. Something felt wrong. He got up and crept closer. The door was ajar, just enough to see. What happened next never left him. Kyle lunged, no warning, no buildup, just violence. David cried out, confused, struggling to backpedal, but Kyle was already on him. A flash of silver, a knife, 1, 2, 3 strikes. David collapsed to the ground, coughing blood, his voice reduced to ragged, wet gasps. It wasn't a fight, it was an ambush. Cameron's body locked up. He didn't move, didn't scream, didn't help. He watched. Kyle knelt over David's body, breathing hard. Blood stained the carpet, thick and dark. Kyle's face was unreadable. He stood slowly, wiped the blade on his shirt, and looked at Cameron. "You saw that, huh?" he said, as if he'd spilled a drink. Cameron nodded once, unable to speak. Kyle didn't panic. He didn't scream or run. He grabbed a plastic storage tote from the closet, the kind you'd pack winter clothes into. Then he dragged David's body, still faintly twitching, across the floor and folded him into it. The smell was already unbearable. Iron, sweat, fear. Cameron stood frozen, still unable to understand the horror that had just unfolded. "We're going to take a little trip," Kyle said calmly. "You're going to help me." And Cameron, he did. They lifted the tote into Kyle's car, a red sedan with a cracked windshield. Kyle wiped down the doorknobs with a cloth. He even changed shirts before they left. They drove in silence for over an hour toward the river. Every second felt like a lifetime. It was early morning by the time they stopped. Kyle rolled the tote into the underbrush, shoving it down a steep embankment. The river was low, the water sluggish and dark. David's body sank partway into the mud. It wasn't hidden well, but Kyle didn't seem to care. When they got back, Kyle opened a beer, sat on the couch, and turned on the TV. Cameron didn't sleep. Not that night, not the next. 2 days passed, then three. David's family began calling. Lena showed up at the apartment, frantic. "Have you seen him?" she asked. "He never came home." Kyle shrugged. "Maybe he took off. You know how dramatic he is." But Cameron couldn't take it anymore. He didn't go to the police. Instead, he called David's sister, Maria. She met him at a diner, her eyes red from crying. He told her everything, every horrific detail. She didn't believe him at first. Who would? Then he offered to show her. That evening, Cameron led Maria to the river. They found the tote just as Kyle had left it. David's body was there, curled like discarded trash, already decomposing. Maria screamed. The sound echoed through the trees. The police came quickly after that. The arrest was swift. Kyle didn't resist. In fact, he said very little. Only one thing. It was supposed to be me or him. Detectives found a mountain of disturbing evidence. Kyle had written messages to Lena in the weeks leading up to the killing. Obsessive, erratic, delusional. He believed she still loved him. He thought David was poisoning her against him. One note read, "You made me into this. I loved you, and you made me a monster." Cameron was arrested too, at first. But once prosecutors realized he hadn't taken part in the killing, only in the cover-up, they offered him a deal in exchange for his testimony. His face never appeared in public again. He disappeared. New name, new city. But the memory followed him. Every time he closed his eyes, he saw that moment. The knife, the scream, the silence that followed. The trial was short. Kyle McCullough pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in March 2025. The judge sentenced him to 18 years without the possibility of parole. Maria Aguayo stood in court that day, holding a photo of her brother. Her hands shook. "You didn't just take his life," she said. "You took our peace, our family, our faith in people. But we're still here. We remember him." Kyle didn't look up. Outside the courthouse, reporters asked Cameron why he hadn't called the police right away. His answer was quiet. I thought if I just stayed quiet, maybe it would all go away. It didn't. Chapter 2. What Lena Knew. The morning after Kyle McCullough was arrested, Lena Torres sat at her mother's kitchen table, her coffee untouched, hands wrapped tight around the chipped mug like it was the only thing keeping her grounded. Her mother moved around the kitchen silently, careful not to ask the one question burning on both their minds. "Why didn't you see it coming?" Lena had been at the apartment 3 days before the murder. She remembered Kyle pacing in the kitchen, opening and closing cabinets, mumbling under his breath. She remembered the way he looked at her, his eyes vacant, like he was talking to a memory instead of the woman standing right in front of him. He asked her if she loved David. She didn't answer right away. That hesitation, she realized now, may have cost David his life. Kyle had always been intense. When they first met, that intensity felt romantic. His obsession flattering. He remembered everything she said, left notes on her windshield, brought her food when she forgot to eat, but it changed. It got darker, needier. When she tried to break things off, Kyle cried, then begged, then threatened. And eventually, he let go. Or so she thought. Lena and David Aguayo met at a backyard party in early 2022. It was easy with David. Light, natural, no power plays, no paranoia. He made her laugh. He never asked where she'd been or who she was texting. Lena didn't tell Kyle about David, not at first. She knew he'd find out eventually. He always did. The first text came a month into her relationship with David, from Kyle. Saw you two? Cute. Let's see how long that lasts. She ignored it. Then came more. I don't blame you. He's disposable. You'll see that. Bet he doesn't even know your middle name. David told her not to worry. He's just bitter. Let it burn out. But it didn't burn out. It festered. The night before the murder, Lena got a strange voicemail from Kyle. His voice was low, calm, almost eerie. I just wanted to say thank you for showing me the truth. I'm done pretending. I see it all now. You and him. It makes sense. I hope you're happy. Really. Then silence. Then a click. She replayed it twice. Something in his tone sent a chill up her spine. She showed David, who shook his head and said, Kyle was just trying to mess with your head. Still, Lena couldn't shake the feeling that something bad was coming. The next day, David went to Kyle's apartment. Lena stayed home. When he didn't come back that night, she called him 5 times. No answer. By the following morning, she was in full panic. She called Cameron, but he didn't pick up either. It wasn't until the third day that she heard from Maria, David's sister. He's dead, Lena. Kyle killed him. Cameron just showed me where the body is. Lena's knees gave out. She collapsed in the hallway, phone clutched in her hand, screaming into nothing. Detectives interviewed her the next day. They asked about Kyle, his behavior, his relationship with David, any threats he might have made. She told them everything she remembered. Then they asked, "Did you ever fear for your own safety?" She hesitated. "I thought maybe he'd hurt himself, not David. Never David." What Lena didn't know, what no one knew, was that Kyle had been planning the attack for weeks. Investigators found handwritten journals in his bedroom, tucked beneath a loose floorboard. In them were pages of obsessive ramblings, thoughts about Lena, about David, about betrayal and justice. He believed David had stolen something from him. He referred to him not by name, but as the ghost, someone undeserving, someone disposable. One entry read, "If she wants him, let her see what he's really made of. Let her feel what it means to lose something. Then maybe she'll understand what she did to me." Another, "I don't want to hurt her. Just wake her up." Those words haunted Lena when she heard them, because deep down, some part of her had known Kyle's love was never going to be passive. It was possessive, obsessive, and eventually lethal. After Kyle's arrest, Lena couldn't walk outside without feeling eyes on her. Some saw her as a victim. Others blamed her. She'd read the comments on social media. She led them both on. This wouldn't have happened if she had just stayed away. 3 people playing with fire, and 1 got burned. But Lena wasn't playing. She was surviving. Weeks later, she was asked to testify. At first, she refused. What more was there to say? But then she saw Maria, silent, dignified, holding her brother's photo with both hands like it was all she had left. And Lena knew. She had to speak. In court, Lena took the stand. The courtroom was quiet. Kyle sat just feet away, shackled, his face unreadable. Lena looked straight ahead, her voice steady but raw. I want to say I'm sorry. To Maria, to David's family. I wish I'd done more. I wish I'd listened to the pit in my stomach when Kyle started slipping. But no one thinks their ex is going to become a killer. Not until it's too late. She glanced at Kyle once. You didn't kill him because I left you. You killed him because you thought you owned me. After her testimony, Lena walked out of the courthouse into a wall of flashing cameras. Reporters shouted her name, asked if she blamed herself. She didn't answer. But when she got home, she sat in the shower for an hour and sobbed until her throat burned. Grief, guilt, rage, it all bled together. Kyle's sentencing happened in March 2025. The judge described the murderer as deeply personal, disturbing, and cowardly. When Kyle was offered a chance to speak, he declined. The sentence, 18 years in prison, no chance of early release. Lena didn't attend that day. She couldn't bring herself to face him again. Instead, she drove to the river where David's body was found. She brought a candle, lit it, and placed it by the water's edge. I'm so sorry, she whispered. Then she left. By summer, Lena had moved out of the state. She changed her phone number, got a new job, tried to forget. But memory is a stubborn thing. Every text alert made her flinch. Every shadow in her rearview mirror made her heart race. She still saw Kyle sometimes, in dreams, not the killer version, the early version, the one who made her feel special, the one who remembered her favorite tea and carried her home when she drank too much, the version that never really existed. And in every dream, she woke up to the same question, what if I had seen it coming? But the truth was, she did. She just didn't know what she was looking at. Chapter 3. Cameron's Secret. The hardest part wasn't the screams or the sight of the blood. It wasn't the weight of the plastic tote as it scraped across the floor. It wasn't even the hours spent driving through the Washington backroads with a dead man in the trunk. The hardest part for Cameron was waking up the next morning and pretending it had never happened. For 3 days, he said nothing, ate cereal, went to work, took out the trash. On the outside, he looked normal. Just another 20-something, trying to keep rent paid. But inside, his mind was breaking piece by piece. Because the truth wasn't just that Kyle killed David. It was that Cameron had helped cover it up. And every second he stayed silent, the more complicit he became. Cameron and Kyle met through a friend of a friend. They weren't close, but Kyle had been desperate for a roommate, and Cameron had just been evicted from his last place. It worked, barely. From day one, Cameron noticed how tightly wound Kyle was. Every noise bothered him. Every guest was a problem. Every text message Lena sent him, months after their breakup, was dissected aloud like it had hidden codes. Still, Kyle never raised his voice. He didn't punch walls. He didn't slam doors. That's what made it easy to underestimate him. Cameron had known about Lena and David. Kyle never shut up about it. He's got nothing, Kyle would say. No job, no car, no backbone. And she thinks that's better than me? Cameron would nod, half listening. He didn't care about Lena or David. He cared about getting sleep and not being dragged into drama. But now, looking back, the signs were there. One night, Kyle had stood in the living room, staring at nothing, whispering to himself. He didn't notice Cameron watching. She'll learn. One way or another, she'll learn. That should have been the moment Cameron called someone, anyone. He didn't. The night of the murder, everything happened fast. One moment, Kyle and David were walking into the bedroom, and the next, Cameron was standing outside the door, staring through the crack, frozen in place. He didn't know how long he stood there. 5 minutes, 10. Kyle walked out, bloody hands trembling but eyes eerily calm. "You saw it?" he asked. Cameron nodded. Kyle looked down at the blood pooling into the carpet. "Help me move him." Cameron should have said no, but fear is a strange thing. It wraps around logic like Alma vine, choking off the parts of your brain that tell you what's right. He helped. The tote was blue, too small for a full-grown man. They had to fold David's limbs in to make him fit. It was grotesque. Cameron felt like he was going to vomit the entire time. Kyle didn't speak as they loaded the tote into the trunk. At the river, the drop site wasn't even concealed. No shovel, no tarp, just dirt, leaves, and the shallow edge of the water. It wasn't planned, it was rage. When they got back, Cameron didn't sleep. He scrubbed his hands raw. Every time he blinked, he saw David's eyes, wide, confused, dead. And Kyle? He made popcorn and watched a movie. The next morning, Lena knocked. Cameron didn't answer the door. Neither did Kyle. They sat there, silent as the knocking echoed. "She can't prove anything," Kyle muttered. "He probably just left town." Cameron bit the inside of his cheek so hard it bled. On the third day, Cameron broke. He called Maria. He didn't plan to. It just happened. His thumb hovered over her number for an hour. When she picked up, he almost hung up. But then he said it. "It's Cameron. I know where David is." There was silence. Then, "What?" "I'll show you, but you have to come alone." They met near the river. Maria didn't speak on the drive. Her hands clutched the steering wheel like she was trying to crush it. Cameron guided her through the trees to the embankment. The tote was still there, half buried in the mud. The smell hit first, then the shape inside. Maria dropped to her knees. She didn't cry. She screamed, the kind of scream that empties your lungs and soul all at once. The police came within the hour. Cameron was arrested on the spot. He didn't resist. At the station, detectives hammered him with questions. "Why didn't you call sooner? Why didn't you stop him? Were you involved?" Cameron said the same thing over and over. "I didn't know he was going to do it." They kept him for 2 days. Then came the offer. "Testify. Tell the whole truth, and we won't charge you with murder." Cameron agreed. But the deal came with a cost. He was marked. To the public, he was a coward, a co-conspirator, a man who helped hide a murder until his guilt got the better of him. He moved out of state before the trial. New city, new name, new job. But the memories followed him everywhere. Years later, Cameron wrote a letter to Maria. He didn't send it. It read, "I know you'll never forgive me, and you shouldn't. I didn't stop him. I didn't save David. I let fear make me into something I never thought I'd be. I don't know how to live with that. I just hope one day you'll believe me when I say I never wanted this." He folded the letter, slid it into a drawer, and locked it. Some nights he dreamed of that hallway, the screams, the knife, the silence. In therapy, Cameron once told a counselor, "I wasn't the killer, but I watched it happen. What does that make me?" The counselor paused, then said, "It makes you human, but it doesn't make you innocent." Kyle never wrote to him from prison, never tried to reach out, and Cameron never asked why, because deep down he knew they were both running from the same night, but only one of them had chosen it. Chapter 4. The Ghost in the River. The riverbank where David Aguayo's body was found had become a makeshift shrine by late summer. Candles melted into the mud. Handmade signs flapped in the breeze. A single wooden cross, hammered into the soft dirt, bore his name in uneven black paint. David A., loved, missed, never forgotten. People came quietly. Friends, co-workers, strangers. Some cried. Some just stood there, silent. Others left notes, tucked under rocks. Maria Aguayo came every Friday. She brought a folding chair, a notebook, and a thermos of coffee. She would sit for hours, writing down memories, childhood stories, inside jokes, moments too small for a courtroom but too big to forget. In her notebook, she called him the ghost, because that's what he felt like now, everywhere, nowhere, haunting them all. David wasn't perfect. Maria would be the first to say,